This is the Leadership and Insurance Podcast, brought to you by FinPro Search Partners.
Insurance companies are businesses and they need to look for the long term and be sustainable.
We went from zero to one and now it's going from one to 100.
Insurance as a concept, as a kind of service, is brilliant. The execution is what we're looking at now.
I think the companies that are going to succeed are the ones that are going to understand and master the art of intent.
When we talk about innovation, we lean too heavily to think about technology and we don't think about creating a culture of innovation.
I think innovation is essentially continuous improvement of existing processes and platforms and product.
Right? It's got to be easy. It's got to be seamless.
Good morning and welcome to the Leadership and Insurance Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Bond, and I'm really lucky today to be joined by Richard, who's CRO of Hyper Exponential. Richard, how are you?
Very good, thank you, Alex. Very good. Nice to be on the show.
Well, thank you for joining me. And it's been a while coming, actually, because you and I think we figured out that the first time we ever spoke was about 4 years ago. I think it was either deepest, darkest pandemic or in and around that time. Have I got my timelines right? Or that's about right, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, I was either nervously anticipating my first child or I had my first child and had been moved out into the corridor where I was in my video calls. So it was sometime around then, heart of the pandemic, working out which way was up, both in respect of working remotely and having my first child. I now have two kids and I have no idea which way is up. But thankfully, we've achieved some form of operating cadence on the business side.
Well, I was going to say it's a hell of a choice, isn't it? It's two kids, it's several rounds of funding later, and a much different business as well. So I'm excited to get into that, and obviously we want to focus on stuff that is interesting and that's not in the public domain as well. But thank you, because I know you're a busy guy, and we're both. This is my first podcast from New York, so I'm quite excited. So I'm here. And I know you're joining the sort of Brit contingent trying to take over the US insurtech market, but we will dive into that in a second. I'm sure everyone knows who Hyper Exponential are, but just in case they don't, it'd be great if you could introduce yourself and the business.
Sure. I imagine not everyone does. I'm pretty sure not even my mum really knows what I do right now, but maybe that's on the axis of interest versus understanding. Sure, we're effectively a bunch of people who are super enthusiastic about insurance pricing, and we've built a platform called HX Renew, which we refer to as a pricing decision intelligence platform. So we work with large kind of commercial P&C insurers, reinsurers, and MGAs, working in the specialty space all the way through to SME, and the likes of Aviva, AGCS, Convex, et cetera. And effectively what our platform does is enables actuaries to build and deploy their pricing models. It will enable underwriters then to log onto those models and use them at the point of pricing, hopefully use them in a more intelligent way than they have done historically. And in doing so, surfacing up information, not just from the pricing stack, but elsewhere in the organization that helps them make more context-specific decisions, whether that's tracking live rate change and portfolio performance or running rapid what-if analysis, etc.
Amazing. I love the succinctness of that. You can tell the teams that have been through fundraising rounds that they can rattle that off so significantly. Well, look, that's great, and you're right, it's one of those things that I'm guilty of operating that on the podcast, in that, you know, my job is to keep abreast of funding news and insurtechs, and then I kind of assume things kind of loom large in my world, and it's not necessarily the same elsewhere, and of course we've got a diverse audience, but I think pricing is, you know, it was fascinating to me. I was reading your the pricing report, believe it or not, this is what we do in our spare time on the podcast, but the gap between the kind of confidence people had in their pricing being accurate and their technology to get them there, I thought that was quite shocking. It was only something like 53% of people were confident from insurers, MGAs and reinsurers, and I know it's predominantly insurance carriers that kind of responded. I think it was 53% were confident their technology could get there, so it's like half of people have no confidence in their technology. Is that trend shifting at all when you talk to people? Is the confidence improving, or is that, you know, the wave in which essentially you're riding, is this gaping gap in confidence, if nothing else?
Yeah, good question. Very good question. I would hope that it's evolving, or at least I would hope that with the customers and clients that we're working across the market, that it's evolving. I think some of that is a legacy of the fact that the market has been very happy and comfortable making decisions based more so on the kind of underwriter kind of judgment side of things. Like people will often talk about underwriting being the combination of art and science. And I think the tools enabled us to put more of an emphasis on the art side rather than the science. And what we're working with clients to do is not around actually how can we get the technical price to override the underwriter decision making, and to there's a whole point of discussion, particularly in my company, because I work with a whole host of actuaries around the extent to which you want to try and get the technical price as close to what you actually write in the end. But it's around how can we surface up more information at the point of pricing so the underwriter can use that to make their decision. So the sentiment we're seeing isn't just that they don't have confidence in whether or not their pricing tool is giving them a technical price that they should actually use at the point of pricing, but also they don't have the tools which are saying, hey, you should also consider this, you should also consider that at the point of pricing. And what we're seeing now is underwriters are actually demanding a little bit more information. They're ultimately being held accountable to it. The CEO's kind of financial plans will be aligned to more than just like how much premium they wrote typically. And so they're asking like, hey, can I see the impact of this in my portfolio? Or, hey, can I have some understanding of, you know, how the exposure might evolve over time and these sorts of items? And that's where I think historically the tools haven't been there. And we're working with the market to hopefully kind of take them on that journey. So hopefully that stat will be improved over time.
Yeah, one would hope so. It's quite staggering for me. And this is something I've reflected on several times on in my career. You know, I'm, as you know, we run an executive search business in the insurance space. And one of the things that I've always reflected on, and this has shocked me ever since I worked in insurance, was how few industry-specific experts we have in the market underwriting. And that was just from a personnel perspective. So, you know, we do have it. I think in marine, you typically have ex-mariners and aviation, you know, ex-aviators, and you do see it throughout. But there's a lot more that have never worked in the industry that they're focusing on. And then it kind of lends to us this trend of going, oh, it's an art versus a science. And it's like, no, because it felt like we just were sort of ignoring the fact there's a lot more science available to us because maybe we didn't have the means to interpret this. But that shifted, and that kind of reflects the shift in, you know, platforms like yourself where you can plug in these additional data sets because that data is so rich, but you have to be able to do it effectively. So, yeah, I think the sort of person and the personnel is kind of matching the data set and continuing to evolve that way. And do you think that reflects on how that might change going forward as well? And not wanting you to speak out of turn, because it's not for you to dictate the workforce of the insurance future, but do you think there is a slightly changing dynamic in the sorts of people that we see in insurance, and it reflects around the data that's available?
Yeah, we're definitely seeing the config of teams changing and evolving. So I think there's a couple of different points that you made there. I think there's actually lots of parallels with the talent world and the team that you've built with underwriting, in the sense that, yes, you're more experienced underwriter or you're more experienced talent partner, recruiter, or so on and so forth, might have more like learned knowledge to be able to make a better decision. But that doesn't mean that you can't think of ways that you can enable a junior recruiter to be able to make better decisions. And if you think about hiring someone into a market as a first-time recruiter, you would never do that without like looking at a benchmark of what salary should be for that person, speaking to at least 30, 40, 50 different people about that. And actually having a phone an expert in terms of an approval process or a referral process or a conversation with someone more senior and be like, I think we're going to make a hire for this. Do you think it's the right thing to do? And if you really want to stretch the analogy as well, and try and like point that towards how you might look at it from a portfolio perspective. If you're hiring a team of 30 or 40, your first 5, 10, 15, everyone will tell themselves as a manager that the first hire, they're going to be as disciplined as the last hire. But the reality is you want to get up and running, and you want to bring those first hires on board, and then you'll learn through that. And based on what you learn from those early hires, you'll actually recalibrate who you would hire in the 25th, 26th, 27th. And we're seeing a lot of parallels to that in the underwriting space in terms of how can you give the underwriter all of that information with respect to benchmarking, the portfolio view, and access to other underwriters at the point of pricing so they can make a better decision. In terms of, I think I'll probably stretch that analogy as far as it'll go, so I'll move on to the second part of your question.
I love stretching an analogy. If you've listened to me ever doing my podcast, I'm dreadful at it. So yeah, I think you were quite constrained there, if I'll be honest.
Really? I can try and carry on if you want, but I think, yeah, it might not be a good idea. And then to your other point about like changing roles, we're seeing people within roles changing and we're seeing the roles themselves changing. So in the actuarial space, we're seeing a massive enthusiasm for actuaries to code. They see it as a critical skill for them to be able to add more and more value to the business. And we're also seeing within certain teams, you might match maybe an industry expert or someone who has less technical capabilities and put with them someone who doesn't have kind of technical, who doesn't have industry experience, but does have technical capabilities. So we're seeing like junior model developers or data scientists join actuarial teams, and you'll have maybe a part qualified or a qualified actuary working together with a, you know, level one, level two graduate computer scientists. And the combination of those two is very compelling.
Yeah, it's definitely something that we've seen. And it's interesting how, so I think it's what I love about the actuarial kind of teams always has been, because you have this level of qualification you have to go through, there's much more imbued continuous learning and development as a culture. And I think that's where some other parts of insurance have been quite weak, because you don't have to qualify to be in insurance. And therefore, sometimes you kind of get this slight malaise in the idea about development, and then that just means missed opportunities. So and I think as we go forward, I was asked, I was at ITR last week and I was on a panel about talent, and we were asked about what does technology mean for entry-level talent and how we develop those people. And I just said, my view is essentially we've just got to be more conscious and more deliberate with it, and we're going to have more structure, and we have to invest more to make up for the fact we don't just sit someone cleaning data for 2 years whilst they kind of ad hoc pick up the information they need to be good at their job. It just changes the way that we've got to do it. And I think actuarial is already kind of ahead of the curve on that one. But that's the nature of probably the kind of like studying that they have to do anyway. Anyway, I think it'd be remiss of me to not start talking about this very significant raise that you made. I was always going to have to go there. You know, it's not been a particularly positive time for insurtechs and raising capital. And many businesses have struggled. And then Paychex comes along with this huge raise in this, say, the market, $73 million, I believe. I just wanted to talk through that. You know, it's always difficult to put someone's foot and go, why do you think you've managed to be successful in raising and others haven't? Because, you know, that's I think it's a bit unfair, but you probably can. But just kind of, I want to know what the plan is. You know, what's, you know, very much, I presume, US focus. You and I were talking about you coming out here. Is that the pathway? And just, yeah, why do you think you have been successful in this period of time? You know, I'm going to be unfair and ask you that, because I think it's an interesting thing to talk about. and then, yeah, what's the plan for that raise?
Yeah. I'm CRO, so I should say we've been really successful because of the fantastic go-to-market operation that we've built. But in reality, we were founded by computer scientists turned actuaries, and they identified a pain point in the market that insurers were frustrated that they couldn't price in a way. The underwriters didn't have the tools they wanted in their hands to be able to make better decisions at the point of pricing. And so they fundamentally built a fantastic product, which the market actually wanted. We focused on building a very profitable business, or at least capital efficient business to start with, which was very unfashionable 5 years ago or 6 years ago when Checks was formed, and 5 years ago when I joined. I remember when we did our Series A fundraise and we were kind of put our kind of head above the parapet for the first time to speak to VCs, and we were kind of rightfully kind of skeptical about the value that a VC might bring and what behavior they might drive and so on and so forth, given we'd broadly bootstrapped them until that point. And there's one VC, West Coast, who stood out as saying, we encourage you to light fire to the money so we can see if you have product market fit as quickly as possible. And that didn't at all resonate with us or our DNA. So we took the what seems like the obvious path now, but the hard path at that point. And that means that our kind of efficiency metrics, when you look at the world of SaaS, our CAC, our cost to serve, CAC is a cost of acquiring a customer, cost to serve, speaks for itself. We're very positive. So when the market shifted away from growth at all costs to, sorry, we still need growth, but we also want you to be efficient as a business, kind of the timing worked very well for us. That coincided as well with a shift in the insurance market. So it wasn't just the fact that we built a kind of fairly compelling business, but actually the insurance market, again, 3 or 4 years ago, when we had our first early wins, and we were like, brilliant, we've nailed this. The sales will follow. And as is often the way with insurance, someone referred to the insurance market as slow and hard. And as is often the way, we were kind of led to ourselves thinking, like, how can we encourage the deal flow? How can we accelerate this? And we ended up borrowing from, I don't know if you know Campbell Soup, the case study there. It's a well-trodden marketing case study around the fact that they effectively released Campbell Soup, and they found that if people were going to buy soup, then they would buy Campbell Soup. But no, people weren't buying soup, right? People weren't buying soup in a can. They just weren't interested in it. And so they actually put a marketing campaign out, which wasn't about buying Campbell Soup. It was about buying soup and the nutrient benefits of having soup and the ROI, like not the ROI. They didn't look at ROI. They were selling to people working on construction sites in New York initially. But it was like the benefits and the cost benefits of buying soup. And once they got people to buy soup, then they would naturally buy Campbell Soup. And we actually had a conversation internally, was like, how can we put pricing on the agenda? Why pricing? We had a whole campaign 3-4 years ago about why pricing and why pricing was important. And whereas in the meantime, I'd say the market has evolved and has put more of an emphasis on pricing being really important, it being the first ingress of data into the insurance stack, but also a way that you can pull a lever on, you know, effectively 60% of your outgoings as an insurance company are on your loss ratio. So if you can impact how you price it on the way in, then you're going to do a lot of the heavy lifting that you need to do on the expense ratio side. And that kind of helped catalyze a bit of momentum in the market. And whereas previously we kind of worked off the assumption that insurance companies might be investing in pricing on a 5-6-7 year cycle, we're now seeing that, you know, 1 in 2 insurers in any given year are looking at how they can invest in their pricing and improve it to keep up with the competition.
Yeah, it's right time, right place, right product is always the thing to think to be. But I think that's smart, that Campbell Soup analogy, because it's hard to. Someone's talking to me about making insurance sexy from a kind of like a compelling from talent pool point of view, and I was like, can we just stop trying to do that? And one, stop saying that sentence because I've been asked to say it too many times. The kind of breaking that message down into smaller, more digestible chunks of like why is this important, or why is this interesting, or why have we got an opportunity here, is the thing that, you know, we kind of were talking about. It's like, why is pricing so important, and why are there so many wins here that we're probably kind of underutilizing? And it seems like you obviously delivered that message, and then there is more, and we were seeing more growth of, even if I just look at, again, like job title changes, like the growth of kind of portfolio underwriting, which just wasn't a thing. Like, people didn't write on a portfolio basis. They wrote line of business specific. And now we're being asked for people to kind of take this broader approach. And most of it's been led by actuarial teams. So it's interesting timing from how that has changed and where, you know, HS as a business has come to the fore. So you've been successful. I don't know. It's always careful of saying being successful of raising money, but it's a reflection, it's a bellwether of probably where the business is going. But where's that money going to be deployed? Is it presumably put massive push into the US? Is that kind of the lion's share of what's thinking there?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So we're speaking to one of our incoming investors. They said there's two types of problems. One is the problem where you're being pulled in all different directions by your customers. The other direction is where you're not being pulled in all different types of directions from your customers, and you definitely want to have the former problem. So we identified that, and we have been pulled towards the US from some of our existing customers, so either ones who we initially sold to in the UK or from the international market and now would like to deploy premium in the US market, or we sold about 30% of our clients. We're on about 30 clients now. About 30% of our clients are in the US. We've been selling to the US from the UK, which, of course, everyone moving online to video calls made that a lot easier. And so we've got that natural pull towards the US market. So our fundraise, we were very intentional about bringing on investors who are US centric, who can help us kind of move thoughtfully into that market, understand it, work out how we can unlock it, and then invest and expand. So that's the main area. We're remaining very focused on investing in product and engineering as well. So we are about 50% product and engineering. So we're on about 130 people now in the org, and we'll be growing that over the coming kind of 12 months or so. And we're going to keep our split between non-product and engineering and product and engineering about 50-50. So it also allows us to continue to invest in building out a platform. We believe wholeheartedly in if we build a great product, we speak with the market, we understand what their definition of a great product is, and then reinvest that, and that's what's going to help us win in the long term as well as the short term. So yeah, a big focus on that as well as geographical expansion.
Sure. What do you think that will mean for the evolution of business and structurally how you do it? I know that you're moving over to the States is the plan, but there's always that sort of challenging shift of, you know, HQ'd in UK, but then US, if it goes well, will be the dominant part of the portfolio. Does that mean that you have to shift more of the kind of senior leadership over? Have you thought about kind of, because you've been really deliberate, and I always want to compliment you as a business. You've always been really deliberate on your hiring. I've seen some of the kind of decks that you used. This is even going way back when. You do some really good decks of people joining the business or people who are applying for the business. We're really transparent along the way. There's a lot of stuff that you guys do that I've used as case studies going, you want to see how to hire well, do this. And I think you've always been very deliberate about culture. Does it worry you? Have you talked about what that might mean as you expand?
Definitely worries us, or at least it's definitely top of mind in terms of how do we scale our culture. You know, we're a software business, so really our most valuable asset, and could argue our only asset, really is our people, right? And they are either motivated, culturally aligned, and brilliant, and therefore build fantastic software for our clients to use, or they're not. So it's a big focus for us, and you know, in line with not looking to grow at all cost. In our earlier stages as a business, which we've kind of stayed true to, is we've never been the sort of company who says, right, we'll just hire at all cost and then, you know, churn them out. We've been very focused on actually trying to keep a high quality bar. Kind of an expression I think that we live by is being kind of values aligned and culturally additive. And that's something that we're going to have to be really thoughtful about as we expand in the US. So we want to find people who are values aligned to us, you know, people who are owners, they push the boundaries, they grow, they go deeper. But we're acknowledging that the US culture is going to be different. And that's in part why I'm moving out with a couple of the early team members as well. We will need to prepare ourselves that there'll be a certain gravitational shift towards the US market. It's going to be super important that we don't underinvest, we overinvest, particularly in our earlier customers there, as we like identify what our messaging and our positioning looks like in the US market. And then we really define actually what is the US manifestation of our culture. And there'll be a lot of it which we hope to kind of port over, but there'll be some of it which just needs to evolve. But I think you put it nicely in the sense of like we've always really overly invested. We've overinvested, we've built documentation, we've thought really, we've been very thoughtful about how we test for that. And I think it's just keeping it top of mind, keep testing it, keep our finger on the pulse. And actually some of us moving over there gives us confidence we should be able to kind of actually extend the HX culture, hyper exponential culture out there, rather than build a completely different org. But yeah, you're expanding out there as well, right? So I welcome any tips from yourself about what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah, well, I haven't got any money to deploy, so I've got to make it successful first. But we've got some. But no, I mean, it is interesting. I mean, we as you know, I mean, we operate dominantly in the US, really. We're about seven. We flip between being 50-50 in our revenue and 70-30 probably in US-focused revenue. And you know, we're a six-person search business. So that can shift quite dramatically. But the culture piece is really interesting. We've done a lot of hiring for first boots on the ground. And getting that right has been really difficult. And I think what you're doing is the right way to do it if you can do that. And a lot of people don't necessarily have the size of team or the investment funds to kind of probably go, right, we need to go and get out there. But I think what you're doing, bringing some of those early stage members and a significant person with the senior leadership team, you naturally have a better kind of cultural, you know, bridge between the two. But then being mindful that you want to allow it to grow, because that culturally additive thing, I think, is a really smart way of putting it, because, you know, you don't want groupthink. We don't want to kind of go, oh, HX, we've got it nailed down over here, so therefore we're just going to go and rinse and repeat. It's like what the nuances of what's different about the US market are, why you need to bring in that kind of localized talent, but then just having a really high bar. And it's taken the time, I think, as well. You know, it's really easy to, says the guy that just decided to move to the US and told his ops manager to sort it out for him, which was my strategy. But, you know, being deliberate, and, you know, joking aside, like, deliberate is a word I use a lot in recruitment when I talk about doing it well, which is, you know, is being big on culture and big on kind of things like, you know, documentation is so tedious and people think it's not important. But when you look at the different caliber, I had a search we ran in Australia, and there was a person that joined that business because it was so rich, the data that they were giving. And they were giving like runway data and customers, and they were very honest. It was all super transparent as much as it could be. And they joined on the strength of it. And you know, yes, we have really good interviews with people and we can sell to them face to face, but the fact that they're in black and white, and it was a really beautiful piece of documentation as well, like it looked nice, and it just kind of felt robust and proper. And I think being deliberate and being conscious and putting all these things together, which is quite time consuming and probably is a bit over indexed, if you go really to town, it makes the difference.
One expression I was taught early by the insurance sector, which was better to have a empty seat than an empty suit, which was quite nice. And like, unsurprisingly, we're a fairly data-driven business, and on the go-to-market side, you'll be measuring all the different metrics, which lead towards revenue, retention, so on and so forth, customer usage, customer happiness, and likewise on the product side. And it's easy to gloss over that and see recruitment as a dark art, and it's definitely very hard. And I'm definitely not fantastic at it. You have to learn, but you can still measure it. And what it comes down to us fundamentally is, are you measuring like the speed at which you hire, or are you measuring the quality of hire? And like, both are important. You want to measure both, but actually you have to make a fundamental decision at the beginning of a search. Like, am I going to, if I have to trade between the two, which one's it going to be? And then if it's quality of hire, then you have to like live by that and make harder decisions. If you've got a, I'm not sure about this hire, but I really need them straight away, do you say, well, because of the former, I won't hire them, and that means I'm going to have to work double duty for another 3 to 6 months, or, you know, maybe we won't be able to do X this quarter, we'll have to do it next quarter. But I can see the compounding impact of a great hire versus actually the opposite impact of a not so great hire. So, trying to be data driven in everything we do is a nice way to force you to make those trade offs before you're in the moment, because making those decisions when you're in the moment is much harder than making it before.
Yeah, I love that. But I think most people aren't prepared to do that. I mean, one of my big frustrations, and it isn't a podcast about my frustrations in the recruitment industry, but I'm going to share one with you. My major one is when people say, we really care about DE&I. And then I say, oh, how do you do your hiring? Oh, we go out to our own network. Those two conversations are not, those statements can't agree with each other, because you're not being deliberate enough to pull that. And you know, that's fine. Like, when you're making your first few hires, like, I've hired people that are people who've been referred to people that from people I know, and some of them have been brilliant. But I cannot sit here and say, right, I'm deliberately kind of going out and finding best in class, because I've not done the work. And I think you're right. I think you can, it's not about having the black book. It's in the same way that good business development isn't about having a kind of portfolio of contacts. It helps, but it's running a process and running a structure. And recruitment is just one of those processes I'm taking DE&I as a very specific example, but even if you said, we're going to get the best in class business development talent in New York, there's a process for running that, and you can identify them, and you can use data to kind of get you there. And it's like business development people, everyone loves interviewing business development people, and they go, oh, they're brilliant, we've been hiring them. And then you go, have you dug into the numbers? Like, do they make sense? Have we referenced them? And the amount of times that people go, no, we haven't referenced them, we didn't dig into the numbers, is staggering to me. So yeah, running data on the recruitment process is essential. Right. Let's talk about trends. And I thought this is a good one. Actually, we'll jump to this at the end. It's probably the most fun. But what's kind of most interesting trends you're seeing in pricing at the moment? Because you are so data rich as a business. Are there some kind of trends that surprised you, or yeah?
Yeah, we've actually touched on a number of them already. And you touched on a few of them in terms of kind of moving away from, one of the biggest trends we're seeing is moving away from incidental pricing, like looking at a given risk and throwing it away, or looking at a given risk in isolation and moving more towards that kind of portfolio view. So that's like a big pull from the market in that regard. Seeing the configuration of teams change as well. As we touched on beforehand, seeing kind of more technical, more technologists come into the insurance space. I learned the other day that insurance is the second fastest industry to adopt AI. What do you reckon was the first one?
I'm now concerned that I'm going to get this wrong.
Yeah, it's a technology industry. So we're the second fastest to adopt AI after the technologists, which you'd imagine would be on the forefront of that. Now, how they define I'll have to find the report and share that. How they define adoption, I'm not sure. They're probably defining it as POCs rather than production. But that's a pretty good bellwether for the industry, the fact that we're moving quickly on these kind of emerging technologies. And we're starting to see that mimicked in the kind of teams that our clients are building. I would say like the team configuration and moving away from incidental pricing through to that more of a portfolio view and putting more information in the hands of the underwriters rather than less, are the kind of key trends that we're seeing at the coalface, if you will.
Mm. Well, you touched on AI there, really. I always get worried to talk about AI, mainly for it's a bit of a catch-all for kind of a number of different kind of technologies that one could put in. And I won't lie, I worry with a lot of kind of carriers deploying AI. And again, it was something I was asked last week. It was because we're not hiring the people internally that have the skill sets to judge the good from the bad. So that's can be kind of the problematic thing. But I'm intrigued to see kind of, are any of your clients using AI in a way that kind of impacts or interacts with your technology? Some of that's probably quite interesting, I imagine.
Yeah. That was my fault, isn't it? I shouldn't have said the AI word.
Right. You're not allowed to do a podcast on InsurTech without mentioning AI. It's the rules these days.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, it's a super interesting space, right? Probably kind of qualify. How are our clients looking at it is probably the best way to answer that question. When we speak to particularly the IT teams or the chief data officers, CIO, those kind of teams in insurance companies, they'll often reflect like this is one of the few times where they're having the business like just throwing use cases at them. Like, can we do this? Can we do that? Can we try that? Mm-hmm. So they kind of feel like the momentum has shifted a little bit versus their job being the protagonist. Like, hey, could we leverage technology in this way or that way? Here, they've just got it hitting them from every angle. So generally, we're seeing our clients kind of like trying to decompose it into three areas of their business to see where it might be useful. So one is how can they use it to build and deploy their pricing models more quickly? So think of like a contextual co-pilot. So whereby you might be able to write, hey, build me a property model with XYZ capabilities. And then actually you can leverage a co-pilot to be able to build that very quickly. So that's one area we're exploring working with our clients. Another area is around like ingestion and enrichment of data. So you know, some of the companies out there, I mean, some companies are doing it themselves using the publicly available or some of the commercially available large language models. But there's also companies like Cytora and others who are kind of helping with the auto ingestion and enrichment of data. We find that super interesting because not only does it accelerate the speed at which you can get better data, hopefully, into the world of pricing, but also it means that you can start capturing that data. So you might actually be able to capture and pre-price certain risks that are out of your appetite, but then you can run evaluation posthumously around, okay, actually, if we'd chosen to price that based on kind of additional information that you learn afterwards, would we have had a better portfolio strategy or should we consider that in the future? How is the market evolving? So that's quite exciting, the idea that you can kind of capture that information, not just accelerate like the underwriter's journey on day one, although that's an important quick win, but also like what could you do with that data thereafter? And then the last bucket, I would say, and this is a bit more, I think if I was a product manager, I'd use the kind of now, next, later. This certainly sits in that kind of later stage, but is around how can you analyze and optimize your data and your decisions using kind of different applications of AI. So like we built out a fairly fun POC, which as an underwriter is pricing a risk, it can proactively prompt the underwriter in terms of like, hey, this is how it compares with other risks. You know, you haven't accepted because of this. Maybe it's because of that. Maybe you want to look at this data over there. So the idea of actually having a co-pilot to the underwriter, not just the actuary when they're building the model, that will help them to make better decisions. There's a fair amount of work that needs to be done before that would be production ready. But that's, we're quite excited about that, particularly once you've got like a structured data asset underneath your pricing models. How can you actually use that to enable your underwriters to be better? And there's definitely a lot of fun to be had there.
Yeah, I think some of those really open up some exciting opportunities. And I think when we move towards this kind of portfolio underwriting world, which we're seeing, like one thing I've always reflected on is like never get away from like insurance is a form of investing, and these are the risks and opportunities that we're trying to take. And the more we have kind of like AI co-piloting and being able to go, right, we're not really interested in this particular area of risk at the moment, but it'd be really good to price for it so we know what good looks like in that space. And then you may be able to take opportunistic, you know, quote unquote bets in the same way that kind of, you know, a hedge fund might do, for example. And I've always kind of thought that's a kind of interesting way to move towards. And we've seen some insurance models which are more like that, and where they're looking at as this is a pool of capital to deploy in a certain way, and those opportunities I think become really exciting. Richard, conscious of time, but you had quite a fun question that you'd suggested, and yeah, I need to ask you this one because I think this is quite fun to share. What's the weirdest risk that you've seen quoted on the platform so far?
So I suggested this question and then I realized I didn't know if I had a good enough answer to weird answer. And then I put it out to my team. And yeah, there's lots of weird, interesting, depends how you define weird, I guess.
Yeah, true.
You know, this is one of the exciting, one of the reasons I'm excited about moving out to the US and building out the US office there is on day one, we will be a startup in a startup in many ways. And we'll be able to go back to having a stand up and standing up and saying like, yesterday I worked on this, tomorrow I'm working on that. And I remember really fondly, we were in the Peckham levels, we were a team of 12 or 13, and we were building models on our platform. And one of the model developers, a fairly junior model developer, stood up and was like, yesterday I built a model to calculate the launch of a rocket and also the orbit of the satellites thereafter. And I was like, whoa, 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 that sounds really interesting. Double click on that. And so we did a lunch and learn on it, or show and tell, I think it was. And she took us through like the fact that you don't just have the risk and the exposure as you send it up, but you also have like, I think it's three or four different types of orbit around the Earth. And so you have kind of low, middle and high orbit. And based on those different ones, it will travel at different speeds. There'll be a different amount of space waste. The likelihood of a crash would be higher, or any form of damage. So I thought that was one of the coolest examples. And then I put it out to my team, and one of them said that they'd worked on a space terror model, which I think does have something to do with the combination of what you send up in respect of satellites and terror. I imagine it'll be arbitrage from foreign governments. I don't know. They didn't give me any more detail. I don't know if it's whether they couldn't give me any more detail or not. But there's definitely some interesting risks out there which are being written.
Space terror. That's definitely up there. I've not seen that before. And I've did a project on space not that long ago, so I got my head around it a little bit. And then you throw terror into the mix. Always sounds worse when you just add terror in.
As it probably should. Good catch all for sounding worse. Yeah, agreed with that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Richard, thank you so much for your time. Real pleasure. I've wanted to do this one for a while. Congratulations to you and the team on the journey so far, but excited to see what you get up to when you get out here. Nonetheless, so selfishly, I'll have another person from the UK that I can hang out with. But yeah, thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast. I really appreciate your time.
Great. Thanks a lot, Alex.